I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. 20 years ago, investigative journalists Donald Barlett and James Steele's best-selling book, America, What Went Wrong, detailed the struggles of the middle class to hold on to their way of life. The duo's predictions sadly have turned out to be true, with many today falling out of the middle class or being squeezed by stagnant wages and rising expenses. Barlett and Steele's new book is titled The Betrayal of the American Dream, where they write about how outsourcing and trade deals, the tax system, deregulation, and retirement policies are gutting the middle class. They were guests on Radio Times when their first book was published. They have joined us from time to time over the years to talk about some of their investigative series, and they're back to discuss the findings in their new book. Both of our guests, Donald Barlett and James Steele, are contributing editors of Vanity Fair. And Jim, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
And Don, nice to have you with us as well.
Oh, yeah, great to be back.
Jim, is there any satisfaction about being right about what's so wrong with America?
No satisfaction, unfortunately, because it's interesting you talk about 20 years ago, because we were roundly criticized by a number of people at the time. They said we were alarmists, that things were really going to be all right, and everything was going to work out in the end. And the amazing thing is the basic things we said then, which is the country's moving largely to kind of a two-class society, the have-mores, the have-lesses, that benefits such as pensions and health care for millions would increasingly be imperiled or lost, and that people would get jobs, but those jobs just wouldn't pay what their previous jobs were. And this is the point of the new book. It's just not about unemployment. It's about the jobs that very often people have. Most of the interviews in the book are people who are working, but in many cases they're working at a third less. The biggest thing that we confronted and surprised us about this is how dramatically we underestimated how sort of the moneyed elite would seize control of the policy-making process in this country and squeeze the middle class faster and more ferociously. That's the biggest surprise that we found looking at this 20 years later.
Well, Don, I notice in the book you talk about the ruling class. You don't talk about the 1% or the 2% kind of euphemisms. You call it the ruling class.
That's really what it's become. They determine. And we purposely don't identify people, because if we did, we would be into this. You would never get on to another subject. And that's not really the person. The identity of the person is irrelevant. It's what is happening, what these people are doing as a group, which is destroying the middle class. And there is no question about that. What we do is we define them as people who can basically contribute to that growth of that top tier.
What you also describe, and it's the way we do politics in this country, which is that members of Congress, even people running for the White House, need money and lots of money. And we have a system where money has influence.
Money has tremendous influence. And what is scary is the extent to which this is escalating. I mean, money's always been a part of the process. But when we wrote America, What Went Wrong, that's almost the good old days of money in politics compared to what's going on now, just the sheer volume of it. I mean, month after month, we see these new records reached. The Citizens United ruling by the Supreme Court, of course, is very influential in accelerating this whole process. The other thing that's going on, the money not only buys the lawmakers, but it's increasingly going into these nonprofit foundations, these alleged think tanks, which have very, very strong messages to convey. We talk about that in the book, how in the last three decades, the emergence of many of these think tanks spewing out their message, and the message invariably is against the interests of the middle class. It has everything to do from wages. It has to do with outsourcing and trade agreements. It has to do with pensions. We make the point, 85,000 pensions plans were killed in this country since 1985. That was permitted by Congress, and Congress bought the idea that those people should be in 401ks and other kinds of things that will not provide this the retirement security that pensions once did.
And you're talking about the Republican and the Democratic Party. It's not one party over the other?
Both in areas of trade and deregulation, both parties share some real blame on this. The tax issue, it's clearly more a Republican issue. They're still locked into the notion of reducing taxes, that tax reductions mean everything. We make the point in the book that the tax reductions to the the very richest in this country have been terribly counterproductive. They've added enormously to the deficit, $700 billion alone in the last decade. Now some of those same people are decrying the size of the deficit and want to see things cut, which means the middle class, which has paid the, would pay the price for that.
Don, I think a lot of people would say that they are a member of the middle class. I think there are different definitions, and we're talking about the middle class, the American dream.
Right.
How do the two of you define the middle class?
Well, you're right. Everybody calls themselves middle class. Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, you understand that. But we look at it purely in an economic sense. And the way we had defined it economically 20 years ago, we just advanced that. Probably the easiest way to look at it, you know, forever, the census has broken the country up into quintiles.
Right.
And so roughly if you take those three middle quintiles, that's an approximation of the middle class.
So we're talking about people making between, what, 35,000, 85,000?
35 to 85,000. We describe as kind of the heart of it. And then we're talking about an extended middle class in cities that are more expensive, such as New York and to some extent even Philadelphia. But obviously, 35,000 in a little town in the middle of Missouri or Iowa mm-hmm. is a pretty good living and will let you do the things you want to do, mm-hmm. buy your home, send your kids to school, state schools, things of that sort.
But why do you think, I mean, as you describe it, I won't say concerted effort, but that the middle class has struggled so deeply in the last couple of decades. Why has that been allowed to happen? Because it seems to me a democracy needs a healthy and thriving and growing middle class.
We're not a democracy on this issue anymore. And that's the point we make in the book, because you see poll after poll of people who would support a change in these tax policies. Trade is a little bit more complex for people to totally understand what's happened there. But certainly on taxes, people support the idea of taxes on the rich. And all what we call for in the book is, frankly, it's not radical at all. It's only a slight step back to the way things used to be. We're not even advocating the rates that the wealthy had to pay back in the 50s.
Which was like 50, 60%.
No.
90% believe it or not. Nobody paid 90%. I mean, their effective rate was lower than that. But one of the most astonishing numbers that we think is in the book, and every time we look at that number, even though we wrote this, it just hits us in the face. In the 50s, the mid-50s, the richest Americans paid 51% of their income in federal taxes. By 2007, the richest Americans, and that's a defined group with IRS,
right.
It's 400 richest families.
Right.
By 2007, they're paying 16% of their income in federal taxes. That's all you need to know in terms of inequality, the way things have shifted, the way things have changed. And it nothing is much more dramatic than that.
And this gets us into the weeds, Don, but is it also because of how we tax, we meaning the United States, taxes income from investments versus wages and salaries? Does that in part explain?
Absolutely. That's why Mr. Romney pays a tax rate of, 15% or less than 15%. I mean, if you went back to the 50s, Dwight Eisenhower wrote one really successful book, and he tried like crazy to get that treated as a capital gain, which they didn't do back then.
Right. But I mean, does that take us back to Congress and to tax policy?
Absolutely.
And
for better or for worse, tax policy is finished. We just can't.
What do you mean? I mean,
the country is so split on the subject of taxes. We are never going to get through Congress the kind of tax system we need. You have to remember, when the income tax was implemented back at the turn of the 1900s, you had people like Teddy Roosevelt arguing strenuously for an estate tax because he could see the handwriting on the wall. Absent the estate tax, you will have entrenched wealth, which will do whatever it wants for as long as it's around. And that's precisely what we have now. And you have a Republican Party egged on by a Tea Party, which I don't understand. There's a mental disconnect with those people arguing, get rid of the estate tax. That money's been taxed already. This argument has been made, disposed of 100 years ago. And the reasons put forth for it at the time are as valid today as they were then. You're going to create the kind of aristocracy they had in Great Britain that this country was not supposed to have and now does have.
The estate tax is now often referred to by as a death tax.
Oh, the death tax, absolutely.
I mean, a linguistic sleight of hand?
They do the linguistics thing to they take your money even when you're dead. Yeah, that's right.
But are we talking oligarchy here, Jim?
We're definitely talking about a handful of people who are determining most of the significant policies in this country anymore. It's not every wealthy person. In fact, a number of wealthy people are very upset by the direction things are going because they feel down the road this is going to be counterproductive for the country as a whole unless you have everybody sharing in one way or another or as many people as possible sharing in the prosperity. But there's a marvelous line, I think John Kenneth Galbraith's The Affluent Society, and it's something to the effect that with a few exceptions, those who accumulate money almost never want to give up that money. Mm. And it has to do with income, it has to do with your assets that you may accumulate. But public policy in the past has dealt with that and develop the kinds of programs that made it possible for everybody to share. I mean, now the tax cuts to the wealthy are contributing to the deficit, but the money isn't really being, and because of that, we're not figuring out ways to pump money back into this economy to make this country get going again.
And when you mentioned earlier, you know, we really have ceased to be a democracy. If this was us saying this, people could sit back and say, well, wait a minute. But we have now become a plutocracy. There is no doubt about it. It's a country of, by, and for the rich. And the case for this is made not by us, but by hedge fund people who write these internal papers that nobody sees talking about where they're going to make their money in the future. You see these simple-minded responses, well, they need the middle class in America to buy their products. Not true at all. The middle class in China dwarfs the middle class in America. The middle class in India dwarfs the middle class. And the middle class in Brazil dwarfs the middle class. The middle class in America is totally irrelevant in terms of making money for the rich because they're making it somewhere else.
We're about a minute away from our first break here, but we often hear, and I'll go back to you, Jim, that consumer spending is the driver of the economy. But if you don't have people that are making a living wage or a wage that can afford some of these things, do you have a functioning economy?
You're absolutely right. And that's, of course, the situation we're partly in now. Those folks weren't doing real well on wages, income over the last few years. But what did they do? They dipped into the home equity of their homes. And they were encouraged to do so because of the deregulation of the whole mortgage and financial industry that says, we'll make this easy for you, and it'll be great, and you'll be able to pay it back and so forth. And we know how that ended up in 2007. In fact, we're still suffering from that. So, but down the road, this is going to be a tremendous problem unless we figure out a way to really bolster that income, to figure out a way for people to make more money, be able to support their families and so forth.
And there's one trend that really...
You know what? Hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a break here. And we are talking, as we have from time to time over the last couple of decades, with Donald Barlett and James Steele. They're contributing editors of Vanity Fair. They have won two Pulitzer Prizes in their work as investigative journalists, and they're the authors of a new book called The Betrayal of the American Dream. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing Education at PAFA offers art classes and workshops for all ages and levels this fall, including figure drawing, portrait painting, bronze casting, silk screen printing, and more. Featuring pre-college Saturday classes for high school students, art appreciation in the PAFA Museum, landscape on location at historic Yellow Springs Chester Springs Studio, and a masterclass with noted artist Beau Bartlett. Classes begin September 13th. For details, pafa.edu/ce.
Next time in Studio 360, Woody Boyd was a bartender with dreams of making it in the theater.
Miss Howe, this is my golden chance. I have to do this. Don't you understand? I just gotta do it. I just gotta.
25 years later, the real Woody is taking on a new role, playwright. Woody Harrelson talks about his off-Broadway show next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Many football players are already hard at work preparing for another season of tough hits and tackles. Meanwhile, experts are increasingly concerned that the game itself is putting athletes at risk.
The cumulative effect of too many blows to the head can contribute to this disease.
In a special broadcast, we'll hear from experts, athletes, and parents about playing football and staying healthy. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Don Bartlett and Jim Steele about their new book called The Betrayal of the American Dream. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Don, you wanted to say something right before the break.
Well, there are all sorts of trends out there that illustrate the demise of the middle class. But one of the more interesting ones is because there's been such a focus on food stamps in the last year, or a food stamp nation and all that. Up until very recently, food stamp recipients were overwhelmingly people who were existing on either welfare or some kind of subsidy. Now that has shifted, and the majority are people who are actually working but don't earn enough in their jobs, and read Walmart in that, that they have to have food stamps. Mm-hmm. That says where we are as a society. It says where we're going in an economy. It tells you in huge part why Social Security will be in trouble, because people are not making enough money that their parents and grandparents did, who paid into the system, for future retirees. This is just unconscionable.
You're saying they won't make enough money to actually be able to retire even with Social Security?
They're not contributing enough to the Social Security funds.
There's a ripple effect throughout the economy. And one of the problems with these low-wage jobs, and most jobs in America now are low-wage jobs, is that they don't generate the tax revenue that's needed. And then you can just spin that out across education, financing, taxes, local taxes. Look at each city in this country. There isn't a city that's not in some kind of trouble.
Let's talk about manufacturing, and you write a lot about that in your book, Jim, and the fact that a lot of manufacturing is now done in foreign countries, and you write specifically about Apple.
Apple was kind of a surprise to us when we began to look at this, because the traditional pattern of manufacturing, and manufacturing goes right to the point Don just made, right. Manufacturing jobs historically, and even the ones that are still out there now, pay more than the service jobs, always have better benefits, so on down the line. That's one of the reasons it's particularly important. But in the case of Apple, the pattern very often in this country was that someone might invent a device. It might be a tool. It might be an electronic device. Designers would then refine that, and then they would begin manufacturing on a factory floor, perhaps near the company that invented that. Salesmen would go out, and they would sell that. You would have this whole chain of people earning money and contributing to the society as a whole. That was the pattern decade after decade in this country, and a lot of great things were invented. In fact, we cite one of those iconic American products, the vice grip. I mean, who doesn't have a vice grip in their home, even if you're not very handy with tools? I mean, they're just such an amazing thing. That's what happened with that company for years and years. But here along comes Apple. These amazing products are invented in the 1980s. Their first plants are in the Bay Area of California, then one expands to Colorado. But within a generation, they're all shut down, and all that work is transferred mostly to China. And we tell the story of what some of those plants are like in China. Mm-hmm. A lot of that has not mushroomed into the public consciousness in the last year or so. But we actually, in some initial blog postings and some actually stuff the Inquirer ran, showed exactly how that happened. And who paid the price in this in particular? Not Apple's treasury, not Apple's executives, not Apple's stockholders, but the folks who used to be on the factory floor in those Apple plants. Many of them had just shifted from job to job here and there, where once they had a bright future, a solid future, benefits, greatest place in the world to work. And the point we make is, less than a generation, this normal pattern was totally disrupted by the company. And we single out, Apple's not alone on this. Many, many electronic companies and other companies are doing exactly the thing, because it's so easy to go offshore, because you can bring the product back basically without duty. And it happens because many of these foreign companies, countries, particularly China, it's not just cheap labor. They subsidize these operations. They do everything possible to make it easy. It's very hard domestically for companies to compete with those rules as long as we're going to let that happen.
Let me quote something that Robert Reich posted or wrote in the New York Times in their Room for Debate section. He says, manufacturing is coming back to America as wages rise in China and decline in the United States, and as producers see advantages in being close to American customers, more stuff is being made here. A survey by the Hackett Group found that 46% of executives at European and North American manufacturing companies said they were considering returning some production to the United States from China. Go ahead, Jim.
This is, we would be so happy if this happened, but we think that's a terribly optimistic phrase, because unless you have the policies in place that will encourage that, that will somehow equalize the markets between where there's cheap labor, there's subsidized business, unless you do something to do that, there's not going to be this mass exodus back here. We make the point in the book that what we need to do is stop the bleeding, if nothing else. It'd be great if stuff came back, and you're always going to find anecdotal evidence of that, but there's not going to be a mass return of that.
That just isn't going to happen. And the other aspect of that is just remember there's $2 trillion sitting offshore in tax havens, and I got to be careful.
Okay.
They are the global corporations, because the domestic businesses, they're being hammered, and their corporations too.
In fact, that's one of the points that you make in the book that I underline, which is the difference between how we deal with global corporations versus domestic ones.
Exactly. And these global corporations have got $2 trillion stashed offshore, and they're not going to bring it back because they have to pay taxes on it. So now they want a tax holiday in which they're offering to pay 5%. Well, they did the same thing earlier in the 90s, and they used the money to pay executive bonuses.
And the 15 corporations that brought back the most money killed 21,000 jobs rather than creating jobs. So it's like even the purpose by which they were brought back, they subverted.
Well, but just picking up what you both just said then, how, using Apple as an example or some of these other companies, how then does the U.S. government make this country attractive for them to locate their business? Go ahead.
Look at it from another perspective. We're always talking about how can we become more attractive? You can't just have carrots. There must be a stick. If you don't do this, you will pay a draconian penalty. So you can do it, and maybe we'll help you do it. But if you don't, you're going to pay a really stiff price. We have never, ever, ever done that.
Why not?
Oh, you kidding? They own Washington. That's never going to happen. They own the members of Congress.
And they have promoted free trade policies at every opportunity, saying that this is going to be better for consumers overall. And every one of them has gone through, and every one of them has, in many cases, killed some fairly good-paying jobs in manufacturing. So as long as we remain just totally wedded to this unrestricted free trade policies and do not face the fact that the rest of the world is not playing by those rules, we're going to get killed like this. Just like Don said, one of the most moving letters we found in the book was a consortium of domestic businesses that were opposing letting these big companies bring this money back, essentially tax-free. And it just goes to the heart of how there's a difference even in this country, and rightly so, between those who are here and are getting hammered by policies versus those who have the option of setting up anywhere they want.
And this is just ethically and morally offensive. Something that people used to take note of in this country, and they no longer do.
Well, just picking up, you use the word consumers, because I think one things that consumers get are cheaper products. I mean, would it be fair to say that if Apple products were made in the U.S., chances are they would probably cost more than they cost today?
They would probably cost more, but on the other hand, look at why they're cheaper over there. They're cheaper over there because of a set of rules in China that we don't abide by in here. If we did something similar to that, you could certainly lower a lot of those prices. Mm-hmm. Labor is a different issue. Labor is definitely cheaper over there than here. But we make the point in the book, if you believe that the cheapest price for everything is the way the entire society should run, then you're not going to like this book in any way. But we make the point the society is one of balance, and you're always having to balance some interest to make sure some people have a right, have an opportunity. We have a developed society, and because of that, things do cost more. And we're saying, down the road, where does all this lead? if everything is the cheapest price, the lowest price, what kinds of jobs ultimately do people have? What kind of and the point that so many of these people made over time was, yeah, let the manufacturing jobs go. Those are kind of the dirty jobs. We'll have these white-collar jobs, these service jobs. But now look what's happened. And the book gets into that in a big way. What's happening to these service jobs? And there's some scary, frightening studies out there about how vulnerable many of those jobs, which we thought were going to be our future, are imperiled.
And the book is called The Betrayal of the American Dream, written by our guests, Donald Barlett and James Steele. And about 20 years ago, their first book about the struggling middle class was published. It became a bestseller called America, What Went Wrong. And they are currently contributing editors to Vanity Fair. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Charles from Pottstown to join us. And Charles, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, your guest talked about manufacturing jobs still paying much more than service jobs. And I noticed that, like, the auto workers now were making about $26 an hour. Now the new hires get $13. Cooper Tire just hired a new contract. The old employees got $24. The new employees are getting $12 an hour. I live in the Pottstown area, and we have a lot of small manufacturing jobs, factories up here. And they're paying $8.50, $9 an hour, which they're not really that much more than service-type jobs, are they, really?
Yeah, that's a,
Charles,
that's a,
thanks for the call. Yes, go ahead,
that's
John.
An excellent point, Charles, because when we made this comment about manufacturing wages, we're talking historically. And if you look at the overall numbers, it's still higher than service jobs as a rule. But this is illustrative of what the heart of the book is about. It's not just being employed. It's that what you earn is constantly being pushed down by these various forces. You know, it's amazing. Even the auto workers at the top scale still earn less than auto workers in Europe, I mean, in Germany and parts of France. I mean, that's what's astonishing about these perceptions that the high-paid American worker has driven business offshore and all that stuff. But what you're talking about, the two-tiered wage structure, is more and more, not only in manufacturing, but in a whole series of things. We have a whole section of the book which says basically the folks who run the country, the ruling class, they think you make too much money. They think basically the middle class makes too much money. So every bit of effort is going toward depressing those wages and knocking them down.
Don, you want to
add to that? Well, you know, Charles is absolutely right. Forever, as a country, we applauded the idea of higher wages because everyone benefited from them. Now, the ruling class did not necessarily benefit to the extent they do now, but most people benefited from it. And now that's gone. He's absolutely right. These two-tier wage structures are just terrible.
But are you saying that the more poor people you have, the more rich people you get? I mean, is there a correlation that if
well, no, the fewer middle-class people you have, the richer the rich get. Because they're not depending on the middle class. This goes back to what we said before. The middle class here is irrelevant. The middle class in China is a multiple of the middle class here in terms of size. And that's where the people at the top are making their money. They're making it on their investments in China, in Brazil, in India, you name it, where the middle class is just dwarf what's here.
Let me get Chris from Conshohocken to join our conversation. And Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
And good morning to Bartlett and Steele. I have admired your work for many years. The essence of my question is, why is it that the middle class seems to be politically acting against its own best interest? You alluded to the Tea Party earlier. The number of, quote, one percenters that you might see in that group is very small. They're sort of the invisible hand.
Well, Chris,
Chris,
if I don't give Donald Barlett a chance to answer your question, he's going to jump through the radio.
No, the other thing I want to say is, if you find the answer to that, would you please call us? Because you're talking about people who have, what I'd like to see is mass brain scans. There's something in their heads that is out of sync with normal thinking.
But maybe they want to be rich. I mean,
no, I mean the other thing, that these people, like the Tea Party people, are lobbying just endlessly for programs that will benefit the already rich.
One thing that's going on, which doesn't explain all of it, because Chris, we can't tell you how many times we've asked ourselves exactly the question you ask here. But one of the things involved here is that so much of the money that's going into politics is not just into lawmakers. It's into faux interest groups, pseudo-interest groups that spew out a line of this and that, sometimes at very pivotal moments when Congress is about to vote on something, maybe right before the midterm elections, maybe right before the election. We have an incident in our book about one of the Koch brothers' foundations that trotted out some woman from Canada right at the time of the midterm elections in 2010, and she said, this was after the passage of the health care bill, and she said, you don't want to have a Canadian-style healthcare system, because I had a brain tumor and I would have been dead if I'd waited up there. Instead, I went to the United States and I was taken care of. It was later revealed by a lot of journalists that she did not have a fatal condition. Of course, the election has been held by then. People watching that, even maybe middle-class people, are thinking, oh my God, what is this healthcare system like? And the thing you never read in this country, public opinion polls always, in Canada, people are much happier with their healthcare system than they are in this country. I'm not advocating one over the other. I'm just saying how those foundations, how those influence peddling operations will twist things and influence people's vote and get them to think in a way that is not in their best interest.
Well, and it's the power of the anecdote
exactly.
as well.
Precisely.
Exactly.
Precisely.
And one of the real problems now, I mean, for years, people, the main source of their information was television. Now it's the only source in many cases. Mm-hmm. And there's a tendency to argue, well, you got all this material on the Internet. Most people are not capable of sifting out the fact and the fiction on the Internet.
Which is actually something we're going to discuss at some future show. You've diagnosed, obviously, some serious problems in the U.S. And so what would fix it? I mean, if we were able to get money out of politics, for instance, would that bring about the kind of the changes, the reforms that you're looking for?
Well, it would certainly be a start because, you know, maybe lawmakers could actually represent the people. And again, if you look at a lot of these polls, there's a lot of support for imposing heavier taxes on the wealthy. I mean, poll after poll shows that. But the Republicans in Congress right now would make you think that the country would fall off a cliff if that happened. But that's actually what people would like. So money out of politics would be a huge step. Then maybe you could restore a tax system that was fairer to more people than the current one is. I mean, what sense does it have making $350,000 a year, $400,000? That's a lot of money, of course. But why should they be paying at that top end of their income at the same rate somebody making $15-20 million a year? I mean, that's not the way it used to be. That's just one thing. And also it has to do with the deficit. We talk about trade is one thing, deregulation. The main thing we talk about in the book is the need to invest in the country, infrastructure, a whole range of things like that that could infuse a certain amount of vitality into the U.S. They're not the total answer, but at least somebody would be putting money into the country and creating some jobs.
And Don, we're almost up on a break again, but do you worry about the deficit, as some do, or the debt/deficit?
Zero. This is just totally the wrong subject. Now, if you want to talk about the trade deficit, yes, because that's the deficit that is costing jobs. This fixation with the budget deficit, and there is a genuine problem there, and we've written about that for years. It's fixable. It is fixable. But the trade deficit, there doesn't seem to be a will there, and that's the one that's really killing the middle class.
And that's Donald Barlett, who joins us along with James Steele, and we are talking about the middle class, the subject of their new book called The Betrayal of the American Dream. Just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Hispanic Institute at LaSalle University supports WHYY and announces a new master's program in translation and interpretation that addresses three main environments: business, legal, and healthcare, where translation and interpretation involving English and Spanish is currently needed and will continue to be in the future. Details at 215-951-1100 or lasalle.edu/Hispanic Institute. LaSalle University. Choose LaSalle for your master's in translation and interpretation.
On the next Fresh Air, America at War with Itself. We talk with historian Richard Slotkin, author of The Long Road to Antietam, How the Civil War Became a Revolution. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Do you know who runs your city's ambulance service? And why does it matter? Also, why isn't Afghanistan a topic in the presidential campaign? There's still a war going on there. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalists Donald Barlett and Jim Steele, author of a new book called The Betrayal of the American Dream. And we do have a full bank of callers here. But let me read an email from Jonathan. He says, if you get this email in time, can you ask your guests how they feel an employer-based health care system affects the cost of labor and leads to outsourcing to nations with other health care systems? And do you want to take that, Don? Or Jim, go ahead.
Either we can.
I'll give it to you, Jim.
Both eagerly take this one.
Yeah,
this is something we really know a lot about, since we actually wrote a whole book once on health care. And there's no doubt about it, the American system of health care, employer-sponsored health care, is definitely a drag on many businesses, and it puts them at a distinct disadvantage with many foreign companies, where that is a public policy. And many the auto companies, as many of them were facing all kinds of problems in recent years, almost all cited that, about how BMW right. didn't have that, how the Japanese companies didn't have that in Japan, and so forth.
And often healthcare benefits are used in lieu of salary of wage increases.
Right, exactly. You take X amount in your health care plan and perhaps your pension plan, and you earn less as a result of that. And that's what's so fascinating to us about the hubbub over certain aspects of the Obama health care bill. I mean, I've talked to a couple of folks who I've asked them the question. I said, what is more radical, Medicare or Obamacare? And they say, oh, Obamacare. Yeah, that's the most ridiculous statement in the world. I mean, Medicare was truly a dramatic change, and Obamacare is this relatively mild policy that's been painted as some act of evil socialism.
And built on this employer-based system.
Still based on the employer-based system. Right. It doesn't come anywhere near the systems all our major competitors have in the developed world.
It boggles the mind. You can say these magic words, socialism, communism. This kind of healthcare system is a communist plot. I don't know where these people are from, and they clearly are not. What's scary is they're a product of our educational system, but I don't know.
You're here to tell us it's not. It's not a communist plot.
It is not a communist plot, and there are any number of ways you can approach this, but. There's a tendency to forget how the employer-based system developed. And it came about as World War II, when wages were frozen, corporations had no way to reward employees, and so they came up with health care. This was that's a very innovative approach. It has turned out to be just disastrous.
Mm. Let me get Amy from Elkins Park to join our conversation. Amy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. I'm calling because I agree that there are some perspectives of our lifestyle that I just don't know where these people are coming from. I'm a single mother. I raised 4 children. I'm an artist. I rarely had health care. My children were covered under their fathers. But this disposable society where everybody has to get something new and nobody wants to fix anything, and I picked my son up from college when he finally graduated, and everything he owned fit in the back of my 15-year-old station wagon. And I was so proud of him, and as I am with all 4 of my children, they graduated from a very affluent high school because I could afford the rent in a very small apartment, and their friends were getting brand new cars. they got a hug. You know, I'm not trying to romanticize.
No, I hear you. I mean, what we hear from Amy, and I don't know whether you agree or not, which is we buy too much stuff, and we like too much stuff.
Well, this has long been an observation about this country, and there's no doubt that that's true in some cases. But increasingly, what we're seeing in many parts of the country is that people don't really have the money to buy things the way they once did. And what many of them are doing, and what they did before the crash of 2008, was go deeper and deeper into debt, taking out home equity loans on their houses, which were made possible because of changes in deregulation that made the financial services industry a nice go-go thing for Wall Street. So a lot of those things happened, and they were very counterproductive, and it's one of the things we're still trying to get out of. So couldn't agree with you more on consumerism, but I don't know many people who could put all their kids' stuff in such a tight space like that. So among other things, you really know how to pack.
Amy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Don, let me quote something from the New York Times. It's from a year ago, but I think it's relevant today. It's about Germany, and it goes like this. Low unemployment and steady growth despite the global downturn have made Germany the envy of its less robust European partners. But hidden behind the so-called German economic miracle is an underclass of low-paid employees whose incomes have benefited little from the country's stability and, in fact, have shrunk in real terms over the last decade, and because of government policies intended to keep wages low to discourage outsourcing and encourage skills training, the incomes of these workers are not likely to rise anytime soon. Germany is often held up as an example of where workers do well.
Well, this is true in this skilled workers. Skilled blue-collar workers do better in Germany than they do here. Mm. Now, is there another subsection of manufacturing? I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, first of all, we don't cite any country as a model in terms of world economic pattern. Is one better? However, and I remember that story. I read that at the time. Yeah. Yes, Germany has some of that. But still, when you look overall at wage rates of many, many professions and occupations in Germany, still doing much better than many parts of this country. The fact that this phenomenon is developing there, maybe they're embracing globalization like we did earlier in this this country, and so therefore these things are driving down. But you still see with Germany some very interesting approach to things, and which that story didn't get into.
Yeah.
When the unemployment hit, when the world downturn occurred in 2008, what did Germany do? They didn't just start churning out unemployment benefits. They developed a program that said, okay, here you are, you're a tool and die maker, whatever, you've got 100 people, business is off so much, you need to get rid of 20. Rather than doing it, we as a government will pay you to keep those people on salary with benefits so that when business gets back to normal, they'll be there, you'll have the skill sets there, unlike an American company, which would go through the same thing, and then maybe have to retrain those 20 people, which is its own situation.
Sure.
But the idea of us actually doing that is so foreign in this country as to be unbelievable. So Germany, for all its problems, though, this is one of the reasons why their unemployment rate is substantially below us. And you hear people say, we don't want to be like Europe. Well, Germany's still a pretty good example there.
And the other thing that Germans do, German companies, they're really innovative in creating jobs in Germany for their employees. American companies, you see it with Apple, their first instinct is get out of the country, get out of the U.S. That's not the case in Germany.
BMW has built plants in this country, but they've also kept their plants in Bavaria. I mean, I think that's the difference. When Apple got out of this country, they closed those plants, and they're gone.
There are a number of foreign companies that have located in the U.S.
Yes,
but most of them have also kept their plants in their native countries.
And you're saying when you look at a lot, well, Apple as an example, just lock, stock, and barrel.
Right. Rather than keeping the plant in Fountain, Colorado, or the one outside of Sacramento, or the ones in the Bay Area,
it just
lock the door
and runs. And you know there is a counterpart there with Intel, the chip maker. Their plants are incredibly expensive, and they keep some of their plants in this country. They just broke ground in another massive one, so it is doable.
there are some jobs that can be done in this country and are needed in this country, and this is to rebuild our infrastructure. We did a show on this recently about bridges and dams and sewer systems and water pipes. I mean, there are trillions of dollars of need.
Absolutely. And one of the most interesting statistics that we came upon in the book, and I probably can't recite this off the top of my head, but it was up until the late 70s, almost to 1980, our investment in infrastructure kept pace. But from the 80s on, and this is the pattern you see over and over again, taxes, trade, deregulation, when all of these things began going in the other direction, amazingly, not surprisingly, infrastructure investment starts falling off. So as a result of that, we need it terribly, which you found out so well in the show that you hosted recently. But we say what we need is a significant investment in that, not just highways, not just pipes, not just sewer systems, but high transmission lines, the whole high tech thing that is possible to prepare us for the future, and the spill off to those jobs is tremendous.
Do we have a skilled labor force though that can do that? Do you think, Don?
I think one of the this is another area where the Germans excel. They train their people. U.S. companies want somebody to come in that's totally trained. We can diverge here a whole bunch of different ways. In the old days, companies looking for classified defense contract jobs had to train their workers while they were earning or receiving their security clearance. Now, a U.S. company will not hire someone unless they have the security clearance. They won't even invest in that. And that's another reflection of just how out of touch corporate America is here. There's a recent story on Siemens, the giant German engineering company, building this massive platform in Germany that's going to, I'm not sure what, but kind of channel the wind energy they're developing. No U.S. company would make this investment. Hmm. None.
Is that because companies tend to think short-term?
Short-term. And they're also thinking offshore. And you raise a point on skilled workers. We've talked to a lot of people about there's no doubt that there are shortages in certain areas, and you'll see this. That's not new, by the way. I mean, I remember once when I broke into journalism, I talked to some small guy in business, and he said, I'm laying people off on one door and hiring on the other. And it has to do with that skill mismatch. But again, if we wanted to do that, if we wanted to have the right kinds of apprenticeship programs, we could do that.
Yeah.
If we did something other than the short term, it's possible.
Let me get, looks like Kathy from Voorhees to join our conversation. And Kathy, go ahead, you're in Radio Times.
I'm enjoying the all of their articles in the newspaper, but I wonder what happened to our humanity and our integrity. But my question is, with Glass-Steagall revoked, what new banking laws can we support that are going to be as strong as that? I write to my senator, I say what I think I would like, and, you know, that's such a little bit that I can do. But what banking laws can be enacted that will be that strong?
And we've done whole hours on that, Kathy, but it's a good call.
No, there's a really good one, and it's Glass-Steagall Jr. I mean, if you've got a system that is working and it's served a function, a purpose, why do you get rid of it?
And this is investment banks, commercial banks.
Separate them.
There was a reason that was done. And now you have, Sandy Weill, of all people, who preached separating them, now wants to bring them together. I'm telling you, there's something in the water supply out there, in Washington in particular, in which they make one monumental error after another.
You agree, Jim?
Absolutely. And the Glass-Steagall point is terrific because, again, we can't figure out what Weill is up to on this. But he's absolutely right. It never should have happened. They never should have separated those functions. It's led to all kinds of excesses. I mean, years ago when you got a mortgage in this country, you almost had to mortgage your firstborn child to get the mortgage. In the last 10 years, because of the fees that were involved, because of the money that the banks and others could make by selling these things and then farming them out to somebody else, they didn't care if you could pay or not. And look what we got out of that, a huge meltdown. They tricked people. All of those things happened as a result of those excesses. Not totally from that, but that was certainly a big factor in our book.
Let me get, looks like John from Vineland to join us. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, how you doing?
Good.
This is for the gentlemen that are on the air there.
Yeah.
I have a question for you. you had mentioned a mass brain scan for the middle class because it seeks to go against their best interests. Their best interest in this country is to create jobs, create opportunity, and have an opportunity which creates ambition. Your structure, the way it's revealed, is counterproductive to any productivity in this country. It flies in the face of ambition, and there's already a tax structure in place that is marginal.
Why? Let me ask you a question. Why is this disadvantageous? What we're talking about in the middle class? Tell me because
what you're suggesting is that we have a higher tax on people that make more money, when there already is a higher tax. There's a tax structure that ranges from 10% to 35%. There's also something called alternative minimum tax, which most people in this bracket get popped for. What you're suggesting is, let's increase it from 35%, maybe to a higher bracket, maybe to 50 or 60, or wherever you suggest.
But who would that affect?
Counterproductive.
But who would that affect if we increased it from 35?
So would it affect the people who work 7 days a week, the people who create jobs, the people in this country that have ambition and have and seek to get ahead, when they're already paying double what other people are paying?
Let me tell you, they're also paying substantially less than people in that category used to pay years ago, when this country was a much more of an economic juggernaut than it is today. So your theory on that just does not track.
What do you think, Don?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the top marginal rate was up in the 90, was up at 90%. Nobody paid 90%, but that was the last.
And it's only on that upper portion of your money.
Exactly. And there is no reason in the world why someone who makes $100,000 should pay the same marginal rate as someone who makes $100 million. This is ridiculous.
We're almost out of time here, but John, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. He talks about small business, and small business obviously playing a very important role in the economy. But when we talk about wealthy people, are we talking about small business, or are we talking about larger?
No, I mean, there would be some upper income people there. In fact, we make the point in the book. I mean, there's a whole section of small businesses speaking out against the tax breaks some of the multinationals are getting or want. So we totally understand domestic businesses and what they have to deal with. And anything to bolster them is certainly good by us, but that's only part of the equation. That's why we need tax reform overall, but mainly affecting those at the very top.
Well, Jim Steele, Don Barlett, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Their new book is called The Betrayal of the American Dream, and they are currently editors at Vanity Fair, right? Yes, I got that right. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.